I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. On July 2, 1964, President Johnson signed the landmark Civil Rights Act that outlawed discrimination on the basis of race, religion, color, national origin, and sex. That historic event was the result of more than a year of negotiating in Congress, which included a Senate filibuster by Southern Democrats. President Kennedy introduced the idea in 1963 and was assassinated a few months later. Civil rights activists, as well as union and religious leaders, kept the pressure on the federal government from the outside. Our guest Clay Risen writes about this turbulent time in American history in his new book. It's called The Bill of the Century, and he joins us on Radio Times. He's an editor at the New York Times, an editor at the op-ed section. And Clay Risen, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Well, thanks for having me.
So going back 50 years, and I think sometimes we forget what the struggle was about, what kind of rights does this act, does this law enshrine?
Well, there are a couple of things that the bill does, and the most significant ones are what was called Title II, which banned Jim Crow segregation, and that was the idea that that store owners and that you could basically discriminate in your place of business on the basis of race and religion and whatnot. And this bill said, absolutely not, you can't do that. The other thing that it did that was very significant was that it outlawed workplace discrimination for those same reasons. It said you can't refuse to hire someone, you can't not promote somebody because of these reasons. And that really revolutionized the workplace. The bill also very significantly put in place an enforcement mechanism for the Brown decision. So Brown
versus Board.
Exactly, which people think of as having overturned segregation in schools, and of course it did, but it didn't really have an enforcement mechanism. And so discrimination, segregation in schools more or less continued apace across the South until the Civil Rights Act was put in, and that had several enforcement mechanisms that really just changed everything for Southern schools.
You say this was the single most important piece of legislation passed in the 20th century.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there are certainly, you look at bills that spent more money, and you can look at bills that added something to, an incremental series of, the New Deal, for example, was a series of pieces of legislation. But this bill, I mean, on a philosophical level, this was the federal government finally after over almost a century of not acting on the rights of African Americans, fundamentally rewriting the relationship between the government and, everybody, but particularly the large minority of people in this country, and saying we will defend these rights and we will enshrine them in the federal code. It was also a very aggressive expression of federal power. Before that, it had been, even supporters of civil rights had been tentative about the idea of forcing business owners to not discriminate in hiring or in who they serve. And this bill said, no, absolutely not. You can't do that. And that was revolutionary in a lot of ways for what the government could do.
It does include sex. And as you have written, there's a representative, Howard Smith, a Democrat of Virginia, described, as you describe, an accidental feminist who included the sex part of the Civil Rights Act.
Yeah, it's a funny story because sex had not been included in the bill for very explicit reasons. People didn't – it wasn't sort of an idea whose time had come, so to speak.
Not back in the 1960s.
No, not in the 60s. It was still, the country was a boys' club in a lot of ways. But even people who supported the general idea didn't want to mix that in with something about African-American civil rights. And what Smith did, he was the head of the Rules Committee. He was a very powerful Southern congressman, very much an opponent of the bill. And when the bill was in front of Congress, the whole House was debating it, and he introduced an amendment. He said, if we're going to defend African-American rights, we're going to protect people's rights to against employment discrimination, we should protect women, too. And the thing is that Smith was definitely trying to throw a wrench into the machine, but Smith was also something of a feminist himself. He had, for decades, had supported the Equal Rights Amendment, as it was proposed time and again and shot down time and again in the House. He was best friends with Alice Paul, who was one of the early feminist leaders on the national stage. She was the head of the National Woman's Party. They were friends and they bonded over this issue. And so for Smith, he had a record going in as someone who, you know, we think it sounds weird that you could be both a proponent of women's rights and an opponent of African American rights, but on a certain level, there's no contradiction. It simply means that he thought that women had a place and black people didn't.
It's interesting to put this act or this law into context and go back to what the country was like in the late 50s. You talked about Brown versus the Board of Education, but the boycotts and the protests and the bombings. I mean, this was there was not just turmoil. There were really sort of acts of terrorism that were happening in this country at that time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and that's what made the bill possible was the fact that you had both kind of a long tail, let's say, or a long head of activism going back to the mid-50s with the Montgomery bus boycott, but also really starting in the early 60s and with the Freedom Rides and with the sit-in movement, and then really gaining speed with things like James Meredith's integration of Ole Miss in the fall of 62, and then, of course, culminating with the Birmingham protest campaign in 63. Mm-hmm. And not only was this a very high-profile expression by African-American groups of their rights, but also was drawing in labor support. Churches were the National Council of Churches was becoming convinced that it had to get involved, and of course that meant tens of millions of people getting involved in the movement. And this all created pressure on Congress to act.
I mean, do you think without this kind of pressure, it would have either taken Congress longer or it might have been a different act if it had passed?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you look at early 1963, and I try to start the book this way, it was really kind of the bad beginnings to a big year. People were very down about the prospects for civil rights. You had a president who really didn't seem to care that much about the issue. He talked a good game and certainly did a few token things to make himself look like a supporter of African American rights, but was very opposed to comprehensive legislation. You also had a country that, you know, for all the support from the grassroots that was building, the country in general was not that focused on civil rights. It had sort of turned away after things like the bus boycotts and the sit-ins and freedom rides, and we had just had the Cuban Missile Crisis, which really focused the country on other issues, and people were just kind of looking to get back to normal. So you had this in early 63, and then suddenly this outpouring, a new outpouring that said, you know, we're not going back to the normal, we're going to keep pushing and pushing. And I think it's absolutely critical to understand how that activism forced the hand of the government to act.
I do want to play a clip from President Kennedy's speech, and this was a nationally televised speech on race and democracy. He made the speech on June 11th, 1963, and this is just an excerpt. Let's listen.
It ought to be possible, therefore, for American students of any color to attend any public institution they select without having to be backed up by troops. It ought to be possible for American consumers of any color to receive equal service in places of public accommodation, such as hotels and restaurants and theaters and retail stores, without being forced to resort to demonstrations in the street. And it ought to be possible for American citizens of any color to register and to vote in a free election without interference or fear of reprisal. It ought to be possible, in short, for every American to enjoy the privileges of being American without regard to his race or his color. In short, every American ought to have the right to be treated as he would wish to be treated, as one would wish his children to be treated.
And again, an excerpt of a speech that President Kennedy gave on June 11th, 1963. As you say, Clay, though, that he was, if not a reluctant, a proponent of civil rights, perhaps an ambivalent one. Nonetheless, he gives a speech.
Yeah, and actually the context of that day is very important because earlier that day, as the clip sort of hints at, it was the stand in the schoolhouse door where Governor George Wallace of Alabama had symbolically, he more or less was conceding already, but had symbolically stood in the door of a building at the University of Alabama to block two African-American students from registering. And, of course, that took federal troops. It took Deputy Attorney General Nick Katzenbach, who was there and essentially forced Wallace to step aside. But that's what Kennedy is referring to, and that's what really forced Kennedy's own hand, was the realization that, wow, if it's going to take federal troops to make governors, who are supposed to be defenders of the Constitution, if it's going to take federal troops to make them step aside, then I have to do something. And, of course, this also came at sort of the tail end of Birmingham. So that's what is really in Kennedy's mind. And this was a largely extemporaneous speech. He had decided just that day to give it. And he had notes and he had some part of it prepared, but a lot of it was off the cuff.
And we should add that a couple of hours after President Kennedy gave that speech, Medgar Evers was murdered.
Exactly.
Do you think there's a cause and effect? I mean, is there any way to know that?
No, there wasn't. Byron De La Beckwith was planning on it already. And of course, Evers was in the middle of his own campaign. He had seen what Martin Luther King had done with Birmingham, and Evers was an NAACP guy. He wanted to do something with his organization in Jackson, Mississippi, and so he was at the forefront of a movement of a street movement to force integration and an end to segregation in Jackson. So he was really at a spear point for forcing the bill as well. But no, he hadn't even seen the speech. He had been at an organizing meeting and had just come home when De La Beckwith shot him in the back.
Yeah, he was gunned down in his driveway.
His doorway.
In his doorway.
He had parked his car and was coming in, and his wife and children had been up watching Kennedy's speech, and so they were all awake when he opened the door and was shot, and the bullet ricocheted through the house, and they came out and found him on the floor.
Terrible. How much do you think TV influenced, if not the president, perhaps members of Congress, or even the country, to address some of these problems of discrimination?
TV was enormously important. I mean, Kennedy gave the speech, and TV at the time, right? So it was a new technology, but it was also something that was ubiquitous, and there were only three channels. So it was very easy for the president to call up the three networks and say, I want all of your time, or I want all three of you to give me time, and be pretty well guaranteed an enormous audience. And that's what he got that night. But no, going back to Birmingham and, of course, up to the March on Washington and then through 64, you had these moments when the movement or the president or various elements of Congress could more or less rely on the power of television to get out a message very quickly to everybody. And it's also important the way that TV news at the time recognized the importance of this story. I mean, the media in general and TV in particular had more or less kind of ignored civil rights as an issue up until 63, and then a number of producers and correspondents began to be turned on to the issue, and so they covered Birmingham, and they covered the March on Washington in depth, and that got out the message to Americans around the country.
That's Clay Risen, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about his new book. It's called The Bill of the Century, and it's subtitled The Epic Battle for the Civil Rights Act. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back.
The Executive Doctorate of Business Administration at Temple University's Fox School of Business supports WHYY. This 3-year applied research-focused degree is designed to provide experienced business leaders the skills to address tomorrow's challenges. Executive DBA students receive faculty mentorship, online collaboration, and the Fox School's reputation for high-quality research. Temple University Fox School of Business. Discover the power of Fox. Learn more at fox.temple.edu/executive-dba.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Orchestra, under John Andrea Nuzzada, performs Saint-Saëns' Organ Symphony with the power of the Fred J. Cooper Memorial Organ's 6,938 pipes. Tickets at 215-893-1999 or at philorg.org. This Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Kimmel Center, Saint-Saëns' Organ Symphony with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Support for WHYY comes from Nemours Alfred I. DuPont Hospital for Children in Wilmington, Delaware, where the hospital's new expansion offers the promise of hope and healing to children and their families. Opening this fall, it will include a state-of-the-art emergency department, spacious private rooms, and a nurturing healing garden. Designed by families, for families, it offers advanced pediatric care and peace of mind. More information at Nemours.org. Nemours Alfred I. DuPont Hospital supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Clay Risen. He's an editor at the New York Times op-ed section, and we're talking about his new book, The Bill of the Century, and it's about how the Civil Rights Act came to be. Let me throw some other names out here. You mentioned Nicholas Katzenbach, an important player in getting this bill passed. Minority Leader Everett Dirksen, Deputy Republican Representatives William McCullough, John Lindsay, Hubert Humphrey. There are a lot of, I guess, what, nurse wives or nursemaids for this bill?
Well, I think they all played critical roles, and it's very hard, I think impossible as a, from a historical point of view, to really piece out who was, you know, you can't really say he did 30% and this other person did 20. I think they all played very important roles. Katzenbach, I think, deserves an enormous amount of credit. The role of the Justice Department in the bill is often overlooked because we don't think of legislation in quite those ways. But it was written by Justice Department officials. It was introduced more or less with their kind of by their hands, and then they really carried the bill through. He led the negotiations, oftentimes outside of the normal congressional sort of streams, and then was constantly reworking the bill. He had a team of brilliant young men in the Civil Rights Division, led by Burke Marshall, who was a brilliant man in his own right, and they were just this reactive force, this force that could really shape the bill in a way that legislation hadn't really been done since the New Deal.
You say that Lyndon Johnson, President Johnson, has gotten too much credit for the passage of this particular bill.
Yeah, I think there's often a misunderstanding about the way that legislation works and the way this legislation works. He deserves an enormous amount of credit, and he deserves a lot of acclaim for his moral courage in backing the bill. He certainly didn't have to. But it's not the case that he created the bill, which I think some people think. It wasn't his bill. He inherited it from John F. Kennedy. And he didn't actually do a lot of the back and forth negotiating. He more or less left that to men like Katzenbach and Humphrey and Dirksen. What Johnson deserves credit for, and I try to say this in the bill, is actually something I think more important, in that he didn't back down. From the very beginning, when he took over the presidency from John F. Kennedy, he made clear that his number one priority was not just any civil rights bill, but was this bill and this bill in its entirety. And all through the following months, up until, so from November of 63 to July 2nd, 1964, he did not back down one bit. Mm-hmm. He refused to compromise. He insisted in every speech, every public address, every press conference that this bill had to be passed as it was. And this was not the Johnson that people thought of. And it's not the Johnson of a popular mythology of someone who's wheeling and dealing in the back rooms.
I mean, really twisting arms.
In fact, he was presenting this stone wall and saying, this is the juggernaut that has to happen. And that's it was a good strategy, of course. I mean, I think there's, it wasn't that he was setting aside his strategist's hat, but it's something in a way very un-Johnsonian and yet very, very remarkable. And to do this in a year when, the bill didn't always, it wasn't inevitable that it would pass, and he had an election coming up.
Well, and he had given a speech actually in Gettysburg that in 1963.
Right.
And this was an issue that he seemed to care deeply about. It wasn't that he came sort of like Kennedy, wasn't new to this idea of civil rights.
Yeah, that's right. And it's I think Robert Caro, in his picture of Lyndon Johnson, he gets this pretty clearly, that Johnson was someone who did have a deep well of respect for minorities and a deep appreciation of civil rights, but had often covered that over with a kind of climber's pragmatism. But once he got to the White House, and once he became vice president and then eventually president, that pragmatism took sort of a back seat for a while, and he began to express his moral sentiments. And you're right, that Gettysburg speech, which Kennedy did not want to give, and it was sort of given to Johnson as that's what vice presidents do. Johnson didn't want to give it, but his secretary convinced him to. And there must be something about Gettysburg because like Lincoln before him, Johnson goes there, gives a largely, more or less unprepared speech. I mean, he had sort of done it very quickly, and it's an amazing speech. It is something far beyond what Kennedy had said up to that point. This was just before Kennedy's June 11th TV speech. It's sort of in the way that, Biden has occasionally sort of forced Obama's hand by coming out on gay marriage or on other issues. And Johnson did the same thing. He gave this speech that was, it was almost as if Martin Luther King had written it. It was full of moral urgency and this call for civil rights now and this radical empathy with the place of African Americans coming from the seat of, white establishment power. And it just was a phenomenal address. A
couple of sentences. He says, "The Negro today asks justice. We do not answer him. We do not answer those who lie beneath this soil when we reply to the Negro by asking patience. It is empty to plead the solution to the dilemmas of the past, of the present, rest on the hands of the clock." Basically saying, we don't have time for patience anymore.
Right. And that is a direct criticism of what Kennedy had been saying. Kennedy's position was always this. If you go back and read some of his treatment of Southern politicians and profiles in Courage, the people that he praises, he goes after the abolitionists. He goes after these guys that had been promoting black rights and an end to slavery. And he sort of promotes people who had a moderate incrementalist position. The anti-Reconstructionists after the Civil War, and that was Kennedy's position. And here Johnson is, a Southerner, criticizing that.
Let me play an excerpt of the speech that President Johnson then gives to a joint session of Congress. This is, I think, 5 days after the assassination of President Kennedy. It's November 27th, 1963, and this is President Johnson. Let's listen.
"No memorial oration or eulogy could more eloquently honor President Kennedy's memory than the earliest possible passage of the Civil Rights Bill for which he fought so long. We have talked long enough in this country about equal rights. We have talked for 100 years or more. It is time now to write the next chapter and to write it in the books of law. I urge you again, as I did in 1957 and again in 1960, to enact a civil rights law so that we can move forward to eliminate from this nation every trace of discrimination and oppression that is based upon race or color."
And again, excerpts of President Johnson's speech, his address to a joint session of Congress a few days after the assassination of JFK. So if he wasn't arm-twisting in Congress, he was giving speeches like this.
Oh, absolutely. And Johnson was not someone who was known as a speaker. He was not someone who gave much, who thought much of speeches. He had given speeches on the stump around Texas, but that's kind of what he thought a good speech was about, was just kind of getting people to turn out to vote. And of course, in Congress, he was known and was a backrooms guy. Suddenly, he's out there with Gettysburg and with this speech, giving these. I grew up in the South. I spent a lot of time in churches, and he sounds like an old Southern preacher. The cadence, the emphasis on these strongly morally freighted words. Clearly, he had been listening to King, and he was drawing on that as an inspiration. But he's also identifying the bill with Kennedy, and he's taking the legacy of Kennedy, which honestly could have been anything. He could have said the Cold War was the legacy of Kennedy or whatnot, and instead saying, no, it's civil rights, which you know, was probably only recently true, and saying now we as a country have to pass this, almost saying it doesn't matter what you think about civil rights, honor the president, pass this bill, which really was pointing a, you know, planting a flag in the sand and saying this is what I'm going to fight for over the next several months.
You draw a contrast between the Senate Majority Leader at the time, Mike Mansfield, and Johnson, who had been Majority Leader. Very different styles of dealing with their compatriots in the Senate, and very different styles of negotiating.
Yeah, Mansfield was not a fan of Johnson. Mansfield was this pipe smoking, very laconic, quiet ex-Marine, he was a copper miner, later a college professor, but had climbed up to be Majority Leader, and he was very, you know, he was the opposite of Johnson in every way. Johnson was, you know, very expansive. He had these huge, beautiful rooms that he had taken over in the Senate and the Capitol to be his sort of power centers, and Mansfield had gotten rid of all that. But he also refused to let Johnson retain any of that power when he went to the White House, and so, you know, Mansfield resisted any effort or any implication that Johnson would get to run the show when it came to the Civil Rights Act. Mansfield essentially said, you know, I'm in control. I have Humphrey. He's my field guy. Johnson can say what he wants. I'll take it under advisement, but I'm in charge now.
And that's Clay Risen, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about his new book. It's called The Bill of the Century, The Epic Battle for the Civil Rights Act. The Civil Rights Act was signed 50 years ago this year by President Johnson. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Let me actually get Melba from Bangor, Pennsylvania to join us. Taking us back a bit to Senator Smith. Go ahead, Melba, you're on Radio Times.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
In listening to Mr. Risen, he said that the Senator Smith, I'm quoting now, believed women needed protection, black people did not. I find that expression problematic. And I wonder if it is not something we continue to struggle with in terms of language, because black people also includes women.
Sure.
So when you say the senator wanted women, that women needed protection, which women?
It's a good question, Melba. Thanks.
That's actually, you know, I think that gets right to the heart of the problem, and actually the heart of his perspective. His point of view was, if we pass this bill without protection for, you know, without something exclusively for women, the bill will protect black men, obviously, and because they are black, it will protect black women. White men are obviously already sort of in the driver's seat, and so from his perspective, he figured the only people who are going to be left out are white women, and so that's why we need this in there. So there is this racial coding that is very much in there with his feminism, and I would say we forget today that there was Alice Paul actually was a good example of people who saw the civil rights movement as something of a threat to women, because from their point of view it was about white women, and they thought, well, the civil rights movement is going to protect everyone except us. And I'm not, certainly that's not the majority of feminists, and that's not the majority of women, but there was this idea, and Smith is coming out of it.
Melba, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let's talk a bit about the filibuster that was mounted against this bill as it makes its way through Congress. And I have to say, even reading some of the language of the filibuster, this is Richard Russell, Democrat from Georgia. He, I guess, launched the filibuster, and he says here, "We will resist to the bitter end any measure or any movement which would have a tendency to bring about social equality and intermingling and amalgamation of the races in our Southern states."
Yeah,
pretty
it's
shocking.
Yeah, it is, and it's, you know, especially for 1964. I think for a lot of,
I was alive then.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, it's you know, that was something you might have expected to hear a generation before, but really, what was so frightening for the supporters of the bill, or not frightening, but challenging for them, was, you know, in the past the South had had often negotiated, had often been willing to, accept a weaker bill. That's what happened in the 57 Civil Rights Act. It's what happened in the 1960 Civil Rights Act. These were very weak bills, but the South let them through after they had been more or less disarmed. This time, they said, absolutely not. There is nothing that we will accept. We will not accept a compromise. We will not accept a weakened bill. We are going to fight until this bill is dead. And, you know, there was really this apocalyptic sense of urgency on the part of Southern Democrats. I mean, it was that's one of the reasons why it was an epic battle, because these were people who felt like, you know, this is our last stand. And Richard Russell, of course, being the leader of that, right, said all throughout, statements about we will fight on every it's a sort of quasi-military language, and it's quite imposing.
Well, here's another one from Senator Strom Thurmond, again another Democrat, from South Carolina. This so-called civil rights proposal, which the president has sent to Capitol Hill for enactment into law, are unconstitutional, unnecessary, unwise, and extend beyond the realm of reason. This is the worst civil rights package ever presented to Congress, as reminiscent of the Reconstruction proposals and actions of the radical Republican Congress. It's interesting to think of these Democrats fighting so hard against a bill that addresses this issue of discrimination.
Yeah, it's I think there's also we often think of the Civil Rights Act as causing the political realignment of the South, and of course it helped it along dramatically. But I think Johnson understood this, and I think a lot of these guys like Strom Thurmond understood that transition was already underway. And it wasn't only about race. It was about economics. It was about the Republican Party being the party of, this small business, middle class, the emergent white population in the South, as kind of the South joined the rest of the economy. And the South really was a more Republican place that had just been held by the Democrats because of the legacy of the Civil War. And so I think a lot of these, and you saw it by the early 60s, political victories by or near victories by Republicans in races. They almost won a Senate seat in Alabama in 62. Strom Thurmond was on the cusp of switching parties. And so I think for a lot of these older Democrats, they saw this as, a real – they were being threatened by Republicans who were running on race, who were promising to protect Jim Crow. They were running to the right on race. And so these guys felt they had to shore up their segregationist bona fides in opposing this bill.
About a minute before our second break here, but it's so interesting to look at the coalition of members of Congress that got this bill passed.
Yeah, it's absolutely true, and that a lot of conservative Republicans who had been adamantly opposed to a lot of the New Deal, adamantly opposed to large federal programs throughout the mid part of the century, turning to support this bill. And some of them did it for moral reasons. Some of them did it because sort of the political dominoes fell in the right way, that they were the party bosses fell in line behind it, and that more or less forced the rank and file to come along. But it's really interesting to see, these labor-backed city politicians like, Emanuel Seller and these guys who were, Democrats through and through, liberals, lining up with small-town Midwestern conservatives.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation, talking with Clay Risen in this hour of Radio Times. He's an editor at the New York Times op-ed section, and we're talking about his new book called The Bill of the Century, The Epic Battle for the Civil Rights Act. His previous book on civil rights was A Nation on Fire, America in the Wake of the King Assassination. And again, lines open, questions or comments, 1-888-477-9499. And you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet @WHYY Radio Times. Talking about an important piece of history. We'll be right back.
Support comes from Widener University. Widener offers over 60 graduate degree programs, including physical therapy, which combines classwork with hands-on learning in one of the nation's first student-led pro bono physical therapy clinics. Widener University invites you to experience its campus firsthand and to learn more about all the graduate programs designed to help elevate your professional career to the next level. Details online at widener.edu today. That's widener.edu.
We know that yawning is contagious, so is laughing, but so is stress. And those who are most susceptible are children. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, we'll talk about contagious stress, what we know about it, what we can do to keep from taking it on and passing it on. That's today at noon here on WHYY-FM.
Supporting WHYY, the Philadelphia Museum of Art, presenting Treasures from Korea, Arts and Culture of the Joseon Dynasty, the first full-scale American exhibition devoted to the art of the Joseon Dynasty. 500 years of tradition, ritual, and honor from a line of 27 kings that shaped contemporary Korea. The exhibition brings many Korean national treasures to the U.S. for the first time. On view through May 26th. Tickets and info at philamuseum.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with Clay Risen about the Civil Rights Act, the subject of his new book called The Bill of the Century. So it makes its way through Congress. The filibuster lasts, 75 days, something like that?
Yeah, it was the longest filibuster in history, and something that really captured the attention of the country. I mean, the CBS in particular, Roger Mudd, who is the Washington correspondent, had daily coverage of it, and not quite wall to wall, but several updates every day. It was in every evening news program, updating not only on the progress or lack thereof of the bill, but giving the day. This is how many days the filibuster has happened. He was often, especially toward the end, would have out sort of with the Capitol in the background. He would have a shot where he was standing next to a billboard with the day count, and it really rammed home for a lot of people how long this was taking and how simple the choice was, and why were these Southerners opposed to just voting? That's what the filibuster was. It was a move to prevent the vote on the bill. And I think for a lot of people, that's what ultimately pushed them to support the bill.
And this was a real filibuster, opposed to the kind of phony filibusters that we see in Congress
today.
Yeah,
exactly. It wasn't the threat of a filibuster. It was a real filibuster. And of course, back then, it took 2/3, not 60, but 2/3 of the Senate to vote for it. So it was quite a nail biter.
And were they just sort of worn down after 75 days? Did that sort of exhaustion took over?
Yeah, I mean, well, what happened was, and they had knew this, the supporters of the bill knew this from the moment Kennedy decided to back the bill, was that when it got to the Senate, the math dictated that in order for it to happen, you had to have all the liberal Democrats, so sort of the non-Southern Democrats, and a good chunk of the Republicans. And there were some liberal Republicans who are Jake Javits from New York, who are obviously going to back it. But you needed more. And Everett Dirksen, who is the head of the Senate, who is the Senate Minority Leader, was really the key to that. He was conservative. He was from Illinois. He was also a very powerful guy. And so a lot of the strategy, a lot of the negotiation in the back room was not with the South, who they refused to negotiate. There was really no communication with them. It was with Dirksen and saying, well, what does it take for you to back the bill? What do you want? And ultimately, Dirksen won a few small compromises, things that really didn't weaken the bill, but that he could then take to his party and say, okay, guys, I whittled down the bill. I think I've got something that we can support. And just, follow me on this, because it's also, we all know this is a moral issue. We've got, he sort of imbibed some of that moral rhetoric as well, and ultimately won the day. He won over enough Republicans, and that was close toward the end. There were several Midwesterners who didn't really like him, didn't really want to follow him on this, but enough ultimately did for the bill to pass.
You think of him as a statesman?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, Dirksen has, in a lot of ways, is as complex as Johnson was in his own ways, and he was definitely an operator, definitely a guy who, did not often stand on principle, but I think, also did see the importance of this moment that transcended the sort of politics of the day.
But it is interesting to think about how this got passed, and also to think about how things either do or don't get passed today, whether this is just the way Congress works, this is the way legislation is made, or whether there was something unique and unusual 50 years ago.
Well, I think it's what's interesting about the bill, because in some ways it's the last bill, or it's one of the last moments of this kind of backroom dealing of party bosses who can sort of command congressmen to vote one way or the other, and a sort of undemocratic process. At the same time, in the way that you see these grassroots movements and these organizations, and there were some on the other side too, people opposing the bill who had their own lobbying campaign. But you saw this sort of starting to emerge, and that's kind of the story of politics ever since. And in some ways, you can see the origins of the anti-abortion movement definitely learned a lot about, or the pro-life, whatever you want to call it, that they learned a lot from the way that the churches got involved in civil rights activism, and some of the same people who were active in civil rights activism from the white Presbyterian churches or Protestant churches and Catholic churches later took those skills toward this a new purpose. And I think you also see the roots of groups like the Tea Party in this same kind of citizen activism, with a good amount of money behind them, pushing politicians in a way that goes against maybe what the party bosses say.
And Johnson was really playing more a supporting role than a starring role when it comes to the passage of the Civil Rights Act.
Well, I think he's one of many stars. It's an ensemble. And, in the book, and this is terribly reductive, and I'm sure English professors will hate this, but it's not Crime and Punishment, it's War and Peace. It's not one star figure, it's many, and some more important than others, but no one playing the central role.
In fact, you make that point because it sounds like you're concerned that when we think even today about perhaps President Obama or previous contemporary presidents, that they have this enormous ability to move legislation through Congress. And you're saying it just isn't true.
Yeah, it just,
and it wasn't true 50 years ago.
Exactly. It just doesn't. I mean, you look at the way that the that healthcare legislation passed. Now, Obama very explicitly chose not to involve himself directly in the writing of the bill, and took lessons from the Clinton administration and their experience with healthcare legislation. But you really kind of let Congress do it. Now, we already have taken supporters and opponents,
right?
Call it Obamacare, and we think of it as his bill. He made this happen. This is what he wanted. But it's recent history. We all know that's not the way it worked, but it's the way it works in our imagination.
Right. But do you think that's harmful to our, not just necessarily democracy, but to our sort of really understanding about the way politics really works?
Absolutely. Because we can, everyone knows that's not how it works, and everyone can see the way that different interest groups influence bills, and yet we sort of fool ourselves by using this shorthand that says, well, that's Clinton's bill, that's Obama's bill, and then we think about it just as these sort of unified actions or taken by unified actors. And in fact, legislation is, even small bills are always the result of lots of different forces coming together to push for it, to push for changes, to push against it, and that's what produces what we have on the books.
This was passed, and when Johnson signed it, he said to Hubert Humphrey, you gave us justice, Senator. I mean, he was acknowledging the role that Hubert Humphrey played.
Absolutely, but of course he knew that he could say that because history would remember it differently. And right. Hubert Humphrey has gotten a certain amount of credit for the bill. I think he deserves more. Humphrey, he lost weight. He was just really worked himself to the bone. I mean, Johnson had made clear that this was one of those things, among other sort of Herculean tasks that Humphrey had to perform in order to get the vice presidency. So Humphrey wasn't just doing it out of the goodness of his heart, but he definitely fought valiantly for this bill. He was assailed by both sides, by the activists, the grassroots people, the NAACP, who wanted a stronger and stronger bill. And of course then Dirksen and other people who wanted compromises. They wanted to whittle it away here and there. And of course then he was up against this rock that the Southern Democrats presented. And it just took endless amounts of work and weeks and weeks of barely sleeping. And at the very end, his son came down and was found to have a malignant tumor. And so he was right at his very moment of victory. He was he was personally struck down. Now his son was ended up being fine, but you know this happened back in Minneapolis, back in his hometown, and it ran. I can't imagine that it didn't ram home for him. Wow, I'm not there for my family. I'm doing this. What choice have I made? I mean, it's a very, it's just an impossible position to imagine yourself being in. And yet he did come through, and he is a hero because of that.
President Johnson, being you know, a very gifted politician, he famously said, after signing the bill, we just delivered the South to the Republican Party for a long time to come. Pretty prescient, yes?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. But I think Johnson was also savvy enough that he knew this was happening already. I mean, obviously, the Civil Rights Act wrote that in stone. But you know, back, as I said earlier, you know, back in the 50s, people were saying, you know, the South is going to turn Republican. The Democratic Party doesn't have a future. And I think Johnson, along with all of the moral urgency that he felt for the bill and the importance of the bill toward, you know, giving himself an agenda or a record with the election coming up, he also saw this as a way to just really firm the alignment between black voters who had historically been Republican supporters, to really bring over black voters to the Democratic side and to start to build a new coalition, which I think, you know, yeah, it's very prescient because that's what we have today.
Well, it's interesting. You write, on the one hand, Lester Maddox closed his cafeteria. On the other hand, a 13-year-old boy named Eugene Young got a haircut in Kansas City. So you see sort of both sides of this bill playing itself out, or this law playing itself out.
Yeah, it's striking how actually the bill was greeted with acquiescence by a large part of the white South. I think despite the fact that white Southern politicians had put up such a fight against it, the public was very tired of the fight, not just over civil rights, but over, you know, years leading up to it. And you know, by then, most businesses had national connections. There were large businesses moving in. There were, you know, people felt more connected to the country, the rest of the country. And yet, of course, they had this mark on them that they were being told time and again was immoral. And it's not that they were for civil rights, but they just didn't want to be tarred with that segregationist sticker anymore. Now, not all of them did. And of course, as you say, Lester Maddox famously closed his cafeteria. But it's striking how quickly Jim Crow fell and how with relative peace.
And he became governor of Georgia.
Yeah, right.
Just to sort of cap all of that.
Yeah. He famously carried his axe handle as a sign against integration all the way to the State House.
Well, and again, sort of looking at the passage of this legislation and what was happening in the civil rights movement a couple of weeks after its passage, the three civil rights workers were killed.
Yeah,
it was
before the signing even. And, you know, that is to say, of course, the bill was not greeted with complete peace. And in places like rural Mississippi and parts of the Deep South, there was still a very strong public antipathy toward any sort of integration or acceptance of blacks as equals. And violence continued throughout the 60s. And it's certainly not that the Civil Rights Act ended discrimination or ended racism. I mean, of course, we still have those problems today. But I do think that it's still worth noting how relatively open the South has become.
But it also underscores just the power that the federal government has.
Absolutely.
To force states to enact laws.
Absolutely.
Or obey the law.
Yeah, and it's interesting to contrast the opposition that the public and the states met the Brown decision of 1954 on school segregation. They said this is the Supreme Court forcing us. These are nine people. They don't know anything about what the rest of the country thinks. Civil Rights Act was nothing if not debated extensively in Congress by a Republican, you know, small r Republican government. This was something that the federal government, that members of Congress could then turn to the public and say, we as a people have spoken. And it's striking that a lot of Southern Democrats actually said that as well. Hmm. Richard Russell, leading, you know, most notable among them, went on the radio in Georgia, back in his home state, and said, yeah, I don't like this bill. I don't like that it passed, but this is the law. This is what the Constitution for now. This is what the federal code, the federal law books dictate that we must do, and we must follow it peacefully. This is what law and order is about. This is what I'm about. And that made a huge difference. Mm. William Fulbright, Allen Ellender, a number of guys prominent senators went on the radio, went on, on TV and in their press statements and said, let's wait. Maybe the Supreme Court will overturn it. But until then, we have to peacefully and fully accept this bill.
And no talk about impeaching the president or
no.
I'm thinking of, some,
it's
some of the things that we hear today.
It's actually quite striking to compare it with how how the Affordable Care Act has been was received. No talk of impeachment, no criticism of the president, no maligning of the federal government. This was a positive statement. By these senators. It was a class act.
I mean, interesting, and no efforts in Congress to overturn it. I mean, after it had
No. Actually, the hope by a lot of these senators that they expressed was fully placed on the, on the Supreme Court, and of course, the bill was immediately tested by a hotel motel in Georgia. That fall, the bill was fully upheld by the Supreme Court, and that was that. Hmm. And aside from some fringe groups, the civil rights bill became accepted as the law of the land very quickly.
And do you think it begat some of the other rights issues that have come after it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the fact that sex discrimination was included in Title VII really gave a huge push toward the nascent modern women's rights movement, the feminist movement. In fact, one of the things that the National Organization of Women was founded to promote was these protections that were not really being taken seriously by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. These early leaders of the EEOC said, well, we all know it was a joke. That was Howard Smith's joke. We're not really going to pay attention to women's rights. And the NOW was founded in part to say, no, we have these rights. You have to take us seriously. And they created a women's legal bar, lawyers who were trained in employment discrimination law to promote the rights of women. And by the late 60s and the early 70s, there was an enormous movement built around promoting the rights that were enshrined. And I think then that gave inspiration to other movements, the Hispanic rights movements, minority labor rights movements, the gay rights movements. These things reverberated throughout the following 50 years and still, continue today.
Well, Clay Risen, thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times and helping us understand our own history.
Well, thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Clay Risen is op-ed editor at the New York Times op-ed section. And we've been talking about his new book called The Bill of the Century, and it's subtitled The Epic Battle for the Civil Rights Act. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can continue this conversation on our homepage. You can check us out on Twitter and Facebook, and you can also find out how to download podcasts of the show. Radio Times when you want it. I'm Marty Moscowen. Do stay with us for the second hour of Radio Times. We'll be right back. And you can catch up with our guests.